Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live this afternoon taking your calls, 410-662-8780. Or you can reach us toll-free, 866-661-9309. Or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. So, Cindy.
Yes, Tony.
We had discussed the topic for today.
Yes, it's exciting. It's super exciting. It's that time of the year. The leaves are falling. The wind is blowing.
And so, what does anybody want?
Pumpkin.
It seems like it, right?
Oh my gosh, pumpkin pie. We typically only eat it this time of the year.
20 years ago, No one gave a darn about pumpkins except for one day out of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And pumpkin pie filling always came out of a can.
Not always, but yeah, oftentimes. Sure.
I think largely around our culture, it came out of a can. And all of a sudden now, you know, it's pumpkin mania, right?
Yeah. And there's so many beautiful different types being grown by farmers now, so that's what you mean.
I think there always have been many beautiful different types being grown, but it seems like they're actually, you see them, you find in the markets and they're being offered and people are actually playing with them. And
that's fun.
Yeah.
They're really beautiful. I love the Cinderella pumpkins visually.
It is a cool thing. My question for listeners is, and you're welcome to call us to make your comments about it, 410-662-8780, or email us if you like, foremanwolf@wypr.org. My question for listeners is, so what in the world are pumpkin spices? Okay. Everybody wants, I know that the world is full of pumpkin spice lattes, and the world is full of, but people will say they're baking spices or they're warming spices. I mean, I don't think that they literally make you warm.
No.
I don't think they literally make the pumpkin warm, right?
Right.
So, I mean, just to kind of be the actual fact-oriented person that I am, what do you think those pumpkin/warming/baking spices actually are?
Well, I think that's funny that you are on that track because I looked at a bunch. I pulled out all of my old cookbooks. Yeah, all my pumpkin pie, basically, research or pumpkin research because there are very few recipes. I'll just name a couple of books that I was looking at. I have the Picayune Creole Cookbook, and it was written in 1942. I found it in an antique shop when I was in New Orleans on a research trip one time with my chef de cuisine and his family, and super excited to find this book. And there's a recipe for pumpkin, and of course they call it poitron or citrouille, which is of course the French, which makes perfect sense.
Poitron is what,
And then I have the original White House cookbook, which was written in 1887, or an edition from 1887. And then I have Marilyn's Way, which someone gave me, I believe, from...
That had been Grover Cleveland chef then.
I'm sorry, what?
It would have been Grover Cleveland
chef.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I have Marilyn's
Someone
Way.
Someone please call in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that would have been Grover
please
Cleveland chef.
Please correct Tony if he's wrong.
Yeah.
Call
it would
in
make
immediately.
Cindy unbelievably
please call
happy.
In immediately.
But I know Benjamin Harrison
totally
was president
you,
in 1888.
Tony. Yeah, I have total faith in you that you know who was president at any point in time ever.
I'm just only living in terror of who it might be soon.
So this book is called, if I'm allowed to say, The Hammond Harwood House Cookbook, which originally was published in 1963. And my
Hammond
edition is,
Harwood?
Yes, it's in Annapolis. It's an amazing cookbook. I love it because it has wonderful history about Maryland cooking. And for me, having not grown up here, I love having it. And I have a couple different editions of it. And mine is from 1991. And then the other one I referenced was with the Mennonite Community Cookbook, which was written in 1950. My version is 1985. And having had a grandmother who unfortunately passed away before I was born, but who was a Mennonite, I've always been very excited to have that cookbook. So I felt like that was a really good cross-section. And I looked in Martha Washington's cookbook, which ironically didn't have anything that I could quickly find this morning about pumpkin, which can't be possible.
Okay, but did any of them mention the
All right, so
the
to answer your
spices?
Question, spices. You know, what I thought was interesting is
that
the
term?
Mennonite cookbook mentioned ginger. And no one else did. And I'm like, wow, ginger. Okay, so the Mennonites
would that be
more open-minded than everybody else.
Warming spice?
Oh, I don't know how to answer that question.
A
but
pumpkin
it's,
spice?
I think the common thread is obviously cinnamon and the books that have Southern influences, for example, Maryland, because there are many Southern influences on Maryland cooking, mace, nutmeg to go with that. And then the Mennonite cookbook, ironically, having clove and ginger. So, and then, of course, the other obvious spices, allspice. And then some of them mentioned.
But see, immediately what comes to my mind are things like.
Like cognac or brandy.
Cardamom and cumin
that,
is being potentially part of that.
That immediately comes to your mind?
Yeah.
Well.
Cardamom is incredible perfume. I mean, that.
I'm not saying it doesn't make sense, but that doesn't immediately come to my mind for pumpkin. But that's not traditionally American.
Well, I'm also on the anti-cinnamon path.
Well, and you
know
just
that.
said cumin.
Yeah.
In a pumpkin pie. And that's unusual because it's a savory, it's more thought of as a savory spice. So, I mean, that would be delicious. Pumpkin and cumin go perfectly together if you
broader range, you know.
Want it in your pumpkin pie. Yeah. All right. What else do you put in there if you're putting those sorts of spices in? I think that's what changes as well is that, you know, are you putting, one of these recipes had molasses in, which I'm like, oh, yeah. And that was the original White House cookbook had molasses, cinnamon, and they also suggested using Boston marrow or Hubbard squash and as a substitute
Hubbard
for
squash,
pumpkin.
The orange Hubbards can be awesome for pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was going to use a pumpkin, I'd probably use one of those rouge pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
Even the people that say that are baking pumpkins, those neck pumpkins, are not the best thing in the world for that. I think the rouge, when they're really dense and ripe, and you can tell when they're ripe by the sound of them, just like almost like a melon. But those can be great. The fairy tales sound really nice. They're very inconsistent and inconsistent from year to year. Like last year was just not a great fairy tale pumpkin year. Or people call them Cinderella pumpkins.
I love those. I just think they're beautiful. I love the sort of blue, pale green pumpkins. I just think the colors can be extraordinary. And if you're decorating with them, it's kind of fun to have the option of not necessarily having just an orange pumpkin to decorate outside of your house or inside your house.
It's just not that sexy to say Hubbard squash pie.
No, but who cares? It's delicious. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I've probably said this before, but my mother... used squash to make pie instead of pumpkin.
Well, people will definitely use butternut squash
we had
because
no
it's
idea.
Just sweeter.
Yeah, as kids, she would call it pumpkin pie, but she was doing exactly how her mother made it, and that was using squash. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, pumpkin is a squash. It just magically doesn't have the name squash as part of its name, right?
Mm-hmm. She was using yellow squash. Actually, I think crookneck squash.
You know, the other thing I would put in that little bit more savory blend of spices that I would probably prefer would be a little bit of chili, you know, whether it was a little bit of, and not chili powder, I mean, a little bit of spicy chili, whether it's cayenne or just to give it, just to balance out the sweet, because you tend to like those things pretty sweet. And if you're using molasses or if you're making like a molasses rum syrup, you know, put that in there and a little bit of heat, balance that out.
Well, let me ask you this. If you're going to do that and you're in your pie, what would you do for an accompaniment? Would you serve it with ice cream or whipped cream or, you know, some sort of sauce? Or what are you doing with that?
All that's in my brain right now is dulce de leche. So
well,
if I had a little dulce de leche to fold into whipped cream and serve that with that or just warm dulce de leche.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I would do that in a heartbeat.
Which is caramelized, basically caramelized milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really rich, ridiculous.
Yeah, my chef that I used to
make
work
you
for
happy.
Used to take, I remember the first day I walked into the kitchen and he was making dulce de leche and there was a large stock pot on full of water and there were two cans of condensed milk in the bottom of it. And I'm like, chef, what are we doing over here? He said, oh, that's how we make dulce de leche. So we left it on all night.
So we have a couple of emails from listeners with questions on topics. Thank you, listeners. Esther in Lutherville, how do you make a pumpkin pie correctly? Every time I make it, it ends up so soggy.
Yeah.
I'm saddened
by
that.
I wonder if she means a dough or if she means the mixture inside the dough, tart shell, which...
I think she has to mean that when you put a slice of the pie
pumpkin,
on a plate, it's soggy.
Well, that's it. Pumpkin has a high water content, so you have to bake it in such a way that you're drying it out. So a lot of, again, just having glanced through a bunch of recipes, because in the end, even as a chef with pastry, I have to reference, you know, I don't make pastry every day. I have a pastry chef. So if I'm making pastry, you have to follow, you know, pretty much a scientific formula to make something. And with pumpkin, it's super important to roast it until it's got, you know, remove some of that water content, because they are very watery. So when you're roasting it, thank goodness you're using a dry method. and a dry heat method, and that will help to dehydrate the pumpkin and remove some of that liquid. So then you have to be careful and thoughtful about what liquid you do add. I thought one of the interesting things about the Mennonite cook community cookbook recipe, it had a cup and a half of pumpkin, a cup of brown sugar, 1.5 cups of milk, 3 eggs that were separated, and they would whip the whites to stiff peaks, and the yolks were just whisked in with the other ingredients. But they had cornstarch in their recipe, which of course is one of the things that's going to help you with that problem. So, and another one of the recipes actually made a bechamel. So you mix flour with a tiny bit of water just to loosen it up, and then you add it to boiling milk, which is sort of like making a bechamel. And that flour in there will also help with that water content. So that's the solution to the ladies' issue in Lutherville.
All right. So we have another, we have other pumpkin and gourd-oriented questions, as I didn't realize we'd get such a quick response. Kim in Pennsylvania. People love pumpkin spiced anything. What do you think about this trend? Give us your official position.
This is
for you.
Oh, I love pumpkin spice. I mean, again, it's just so indicative. If this time of the year, we all have so many
coffee.
Traditions. Sure, why not? Yum. I mean, it's a beautiful mix of spices that are traditional.
Pumpkin pie ice
Tony's
cream.
Tony's very serious right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm just
okay. Yeah, definitely. We make a great ice cream. What did I make the other day? I was working on. Working with squash, the yellow crookneck squash, because I have some in my garden, and I was working on a recipe where I kind of ended up using a very tiny amount, because you can blow out the flavor of the squash pretty quickly, of things that you would traditionally find in pumpkin and pumpkin pie. And it's that time of the year. Also, we all love cider, and a lot of those spices are so good with cider too. Warming cider on the stove, all these things are wonderful tradition and make us think of family.
And one of the related question, Brit, from I don't know where, Brit, butternut squash soup. I can't get it right. You want to? How about a 1 minute recipe for listeners for butternut squash soup that they're gonna like?
One of the fun things about working with butternut squash is that you can boil it. So you can do everything in one pot without having to involve your oven.
It doesn't require too much touch.
No, the biggest thing with butternut squash is removing the shell from the butternut squash, and again, just be very careful.
Enough of the shell.
Yeah, and also very sharp knife, but be very, very careful. When you do cut it open, you also want to remove the seeds from the bottom pocket. And I roast those, so we wash them, dry them, and you can season those however you want. Like you're talking about cumin, toasted pumpkin seeds, butternut squash seeds would be amazing. And what's nice is I've turned that into the garnish for my soup. So, you know, with butternut squash making a great soup, I'll just quickly say mine, which has cocoa beans and andouille sausage, onion, a little bit of shallot, and good chicken stock, and salt and pepper. And so I'm not putting any other, and I might put a little cayenne in or a little bit of Tabasco,
but that's not doing any sort of earthy. Yeah. And then you're just pureeing it.
Mm-hmm. Pureeing it and straining it. I'm not adding any cream. There's almost no butter in it, or you can make it entirely without butter. So if you're looking for something that's pretty healthy, that's a good way to go. And that is a soup that, particularly with the beans are what helps to make it creamy. But if you wanted to go in a completely different direction, I would definitely consider using a little bit of cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, a little bit of rum or cognac or brandy to make a soup as well. But I think the chicken stock is pretty important to taking it from feeling like it's pumpkin pie or squash or
something
or whatever.
Very squashy,
yeah,
making it taste
to taking it to being
like
a savory soup.
Yeah.
Yeah, so be careful with any of those spices that you might use that might traditionally be in a pie.
I think one of the basic errors that people can make with this kind of thing is they don't sufficiently season it. If it's lacking salt, it's just going to lack flavor.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of an item. One. And two, I think a lot of times people will try to make a soup that day to serve it that day. And so often, even just a few hours of time for it to be cool and for the flavors to set and to mingle and then warm it back up, whether it's overnight or it's, you're much better off making that kind of thing the day ahead and then serving it, heating it.
I agree.
The flavor would be much more concentrated, much more commingled.
Well, that's it. And that's how nice is that to be able, because, I mean, in my cooking, I'm always striving for making it as fresh as possible, you know, everything made right now, you know, and that's the way that I should be cooking. And it is nice that there are some things that actually benefit from time, as you're saying.
Yeah, not that many soups are better with a little bit of time.
Right.
Well, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll continue the live program. We're taking your calls, 410-662-8780. And no, you don't have to just call us about pumpkins. You can call us about anything that's on your mind in the world of food and wine. You can email us, formanwolf@wypr.org. And we'll be back shortly on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Chef, remember, in the third segment, you're in deep trouble.
Oh, I can't wait. I love Chef's Challenge. Yeah, that's fun. Yeah. I'm ready.
Hope you have a good
Bring it on, man.
All right.
You're going to love yours.
Did you have coffee or anything?
No. Can you tell I have not had coffee or food today? So I can't wait to get to the other part of the segment. It's going to be bad.
Well, we're live today and taking your calls, 410-662-8780, or toll-free, 866-661-9309, or email us if you're a bit shy, formanwolf@wypr.org. We've gotten several of those so far this morning. We have Sue in Parkville who just says she does not like pumpkin at all.
Uh-oh. Okay. All right.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely.
That's okay. When I was a kid, I didn't like broccoli.
Oh, yeah, me either. Or cauliflower.
Actually, I wasn't allowed to talk about it. I wasn't allowed to say I didn't like it.
Okay.
As German Catholic family, it's what you get. And we have Bob in Parkville. Root vegetables should be shining soon. Oh, nice turn of phrase, Bob. Do you have any great root vegetable recipes? Do you have any pets right now?
I haven't been working, actually, too much so far this fall with root vegetables. We're kind of on that, like, edge of ending summer food. I'm still serving crab cakes.
This last week, we got the best peppers of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and usually
we're
you get
still
them
getting
in the end of August.
Some really nice ripe red tomatoes, which I'm surprised by. I mean, they're not, you know, it's just a slicing tomato, but they're good. We've been making, you know, salsas and relishes and things.
I think tonight's going to be the end of that. It's going to be below 50. Yeah, it's going to be below 50 in a lot of areas. And
yeah, one of my cooks mentioned to me the other day that he thought he saw frost. And I'm like, ugh, that's going to be the end of that. But
yeah, it won't be. It's long before frost, but once you get down below like 54 degrees. It's problematic.
Right. But yes, so you know, just kind of on that edge, but with one of the things that I really love is sunchokes or Jerusalem artichokes, and I haven't worked with those in a while, and just sort of
won't get them for a while. But they're great.
Well, you can buy them. Nevertheless, you can still get them. Chips, yeah. Oh. And I was just thinking, is there a game today? Because I thought I saw a lot of people in Ravens outfits. But
yes, there is a football game today.
Okay, all right. I don't know.
Cindy Wolf, ladies and gentlemen, biggest sports fan in Baltimore.
Hey, my life is about food.
Just because 400,000 people are wearing purple doesn't mean it's a football game. Oh, no, it's a conspiracy.
Oh, boy. I was just thinking how fun
it would
be. I have
a dress shirt on. You
if
know?
I, oh, well, it doesn't, okay. If I were to, you know, have people over for a football game, which apparently we now all know won't happen, I would make sunchoke chips because I love them. I think a great big bowl of those things on the table would be so good. And it's just, you know, you just want to slice them paper thin and lay them out and dry them in the oven with a little bit of salt and or you can fry them. And they're just so good because they're so inherently sweet and they just have such an unusual flavor. They taste like absolutely nothing else. So that's fun. And then as far
the only thing they're related to that we eat, do you know what it is?
No.
Genetically, yeah.
I have no idea.
Oh.
Tell us. I can't wait.
White truffles.
Oh.
White truffles.
What?
They're
really?
Related. Yeah.
Huh. That's cool.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that is crazy.
White truffle's not a mushroom at all. It's a vegetable. It's related to Jerusalem artichokes.
Huh. That's it. Well, that, you know, white truffles have such a different flavor profile from, like, say, winter black truffles. Yeah. That it does not surprise me. I didn't realize.
The White Truffle Festival in Alba is this week.
Not, oh, I know. And I'm just.
Is this week?
I wish,
what are you
wish
doing
that was
here?
So expensive. I know. I should be there. I should be there. How much fun would that be to go to? Oh,
I mean, all the best ones come later in
October
and November.
White Truffle Festival?
But yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I don't have to make that.
So, but you can still make
trip 1 year for that festival.
Sunchoke chips.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty great.
I don't think you can really, you know, with Jerusalem artichokes or sunchokes, it's very difficult to make a nice puree from them because they are very, I'll say, woody in texture.
They're also the devil to clean.
Oh, they are not fun. They look a lot like ginger or turmeric.
Yeah.
So it is not easy to clean. They're not easy to work with. And so I would not suggest making a puree. I would definitely do something like make chips with them. And then parsnips are one of my other favorite root vegetables. And, oh gosh, again, inherently sweet and just absolutely beautiful. Have a kind of almost like this unbelievable perfume to them. And I like to roast parsnips, but you could definitely make a beautiful parsnip puree. And something that I know
they're definitely woodsy too. You really have to be careful in the texture on that puree.
Oh, definitely. But I think if I was going to make parsnip puree, I would just make sure I passed it through a tammy. And that's it. You know, you're going to solve everything. Or put it in a high-speed blender and then pass it through a tammy. So, you know, you're going to have to either pass it through a food mill or a tammy. And it's funny because, again, looking at some of those pretty old recipes for pumpkin pie, one of the recipes said to pass it through a colander. And thankfully, we have food mills. And I would say pass it through a food mill. I mean, certainly if you don't have the equipment in the kitchen and you only have a colander, go for it. Do it. But a food mill, you know, is a pretty basic piece of equipment, and you can do a billion things with a food mill.
I like how they say pass it through. It's called press it through. Take your hand and squeeze all the pumpkin through the colander that you possibly can, which is
a lot easier to do with a food mill,
which
has a blade on it, and hand crank. And then just, you know, with the idea of working with parsnips, you can do that. And then just, like I said, make sure you pass it through a tammy. But I think parsnips is a flavor profile. Definitely love butter, a little cream, salt and pepper, but I don't really see putting a lot of spices with parsnips. They're just gorgeous on their own.
So the other thing that's going to be great on what's I did not know is your empty stomach is I thought we might actually taste some wine for listeners.
That'd be fine.
And maybe kind of go through the process of what
what
you're supposed to do in
tasting. Okay.
I think that there are a million sort of schools of this sort of thing now, and I don't know that folks always, I think they expect to take something from the glass. You know, you ever see the person, I think sometimes what puts people off from interest in wine are some other wine drinkers who are really aggressive about what they're getting from the wine.
And then these people are left to wonder why they don't get anything because they don't understand what they're even talking about, which I understand.
You don't walk up and look at a painting and try to pull, you know, literally pull out of the painting what it is that you're going to you're going to enjoy it much more if you receive what's there. You know, if you're in a calm state and you actually receive what's there. So that's literally, and it sounds a little, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm a kid from the 70s, you know. That's, but it's maybe a little more touchy-feely than some people begin their approach, but I think it's important because some people are so academic. I think that you can use academics to learn about wine.
Of course.
But the point of it is it is a sensual experience.
Absolutely.
It's, you know.
And that's, honestly, that's how I look at it. I look at it as, I don't need to have all these things running around in my head about all this information. I just enjoy it. I think it's a beautiful thing. I appreciate the work that went into making it and the fact that it comes from the earth.
So when you teach someone to taste, you're just teaching them to kind of use their senses and tune into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to break it down into different senses. So I did pour something in a glass for us.
Well, this is a fun radio show.
Yeah, well, clearly WIPR management has no idea we're doing this. So... up until now.
Okay.
At any rate, so what I poured was a Pommard, and Pommard is a village in Burgundy, and Pommard is, and like all villages in Burgundy, the wine's known by the name of the village, where it grows, or the vineyards around the village, and by law, it has to be 100% Pinot Noir. And this bottling is, it says Vieille Vigne, or Old Vines on the label.
Mm-hmm.
So this producer, the house of Joseph Voyot, V-O-I-L-L-O-T, if people want to look it up on a on a website or anything like that. It's Joseph Voyot. This wine all comes from 35 and older year vines, which usually means less fruit comes from the vine, more intensity, sure. Deeper roots, so you probably get more mineral flavor. You would expect more mineral flavor. And since that's the big draw in Burgundy, you know,
Minerality.
That's part of what it shows off, which doesn't sound like the most fun thing in the world, right?
No.
So we'll talk about it. So
I love Burgundy.
When you take a look at it, one of the senses you're going to use is your sight. If you can look at the glass against paper, and this is a red wine, so you're going to see. I mean, the funny thing is, wine looks like wine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like when you go to smell it smells like wine. Of course it does.
Right.
However, you can use more to identify it than just that. You can see against the paper that this is clear, and usually the red color that's there falls in one of three hues. It can tend to look more sort of pink or magenta, what the Brits always call ruby. It can fall a little more orange or brick, let's say, sort of maroon, and that they'll call garnet. Or there are a few grapes that have literally a purple hue, and violet is what that ends up getting called by the fancy taster guys. But you can see this, the color is a little bit deeper in the center, but the wine is relatively sheer. Pinot Noir is a thin-skinned grape, and so because of that, there's not that much. When they crush it, there's a lot of juice, and there's a small amount of material from the skins. And since the material from the skins is what actually gives the wine its color, the flesh is relatively clear, that juice is relatively clear. So the ratio of flesh to the actual juice is pretty low, so it doesn't give it an incredibly deep color.
Okay.
You can do things to manipulate that with Pinot Noir, but sometimes that leads to kind of unattractive qualities.
Okay.
With that.
Like what would...
It may become more tannic. It may really dull the nose, honestly. There's,
all right.
There's a lot of ways of condemning those sorts of practices, frankly.
It smells good in here. We're not in a very big room, and no. I can really smell the wine. It smells great.
Well, one of the pleasures of Burgundy in particular, and you would hope for Pinot Noir, the grape, is aromatics are one of the real pleasures. I think that, so if you take the time and actually give it a swirl, and you can see the wine falling down the sides of the glass. It's not incredibly thick tears or legs going down. It's not the oiliest stuff in the world. The alcohol is not that high.
Okay.
This is a cool growing zone. The alcohol is not going to be that high. There's not so much sun that the sugars get so high that the alcohols are high.
What's an example of a hot growing zone?
Napa, California.
Okay.
Where Pinot Noir has incredibly different character from this. So if you go ahead and put your nose in the glass, you notice a lot of things at once, right? That's one of the things that's hardest to do is to slow it down. And it's not just as simple as, well, you know, does it smell like a fruit? Well, it does. It's a 2009 vintage. So at 7 years of age, it's beginning to show secondary characteristics, meaning it's not just the primary characteristic for something made from fruit is fruit.
Right.
You know, so you expect the fruit smells, but there are additional aromas as well. So... is there a fruit that it reminds you of at all?
It feels like dry. It smells like dried fruit to me. It feels very reductive. I mean, it's very intense.
2009 is
a
hot
super
year.
Intense.
So that's,
yeah. It's almost pruny or not plum. I don't know. I think pruny. It's pretty.
Pommard can run in that like cherry plum range.
Okay. Yeah.
That the funny thing is in Burgundy they've grown Pinot Noir in the same places for so long. That you begin to find characteristics that are very particular to the grape in the particular places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I was going to say something ridiculous, I would say, well, it's very Pommard, the nose.
Well, but that's also good, too, for someone learning, because they're like, oh, okay, yeah. This is super indicative of that region.
It's a very good example. It's a very good example, cool, literally, of that village in a warm year.
It's also a little funky. You know, it's definitely a little gamey, funky kind of on the nose. So.
Funky, yeah.
Yeah.
Has a good beat. So... Yeah, the earthy aromas that are there, there is a little, like, you know, not a mushroomy thing, but like a foresty.
I was going to say mushroomy. A very, yeah,
like,
it's
foresty,
I'm that
like
now.
Porcini mushroom, that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Not mushroom, like there's something wrong with it, but almost
in
like.
In a good way, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely like porcini, like, and there's definitely something forest floor like for sure. And yeah. That, and meaning, you know, more the mushroom.
And you can smell. When people say, oh, the minerality literally means geologic expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect to notice. In Burgundy in particular, it's almost always very slightly different metallic notes in the different wines. So mixed in with that perfume, with the cherries and plum, with the forest flora, with the porcinis, with a little balsamy kind of note.
Balsamy, that's good. Yeah, I like that.
That it has, that little woodsy...
When I clean chanterelle mushrooms and I have to immerse them in water in the sink because they're wild, I get so many so many fern pieces, and it's almost like that, you know, that fern earth.
So
pine needle.
We've got there's some of those things. There's nothing piney about it.
No, I agree. Yes, I didn't. Yeah, there's nothing piney about it. Okay, so, cool, fun.
Do you want to take the question? Yes. Always is when you're tasting it. And you want to percolate a little bit of the wine in your mouth. Probably not nice on air.
Mm-mm.
But if you aerate it in your mouth a little bit, the beginning,
gulping.
gulping is pretty tasty. It's worth gulping. The things that you notice, the first bit of analysis you want to do is it doing what I thought it would do? You know, are the promises from the nose, all those notes that you hear. Are you hearing the same things? Are you tasting the same things on the palate?
Which I think is really interesting because often they don't match. So, you know, the nose and the what you expected can be different in the glass.
And I think that's not so bad.
That is really beautiful.
And this is a village level wine. This is not one of the fancies. This is
That's
not
great.
A Premier Cru or a Grand Cru Red Burgundy. One of the other things you're going to notice that you obviously can't notice on the nose are all the texture pieces, and the functionality of the wine with food has everything to do with the texture. It's not just the fruit is what you expect. It is that cherry plum. It's more cherry on the palate and less plum.
It really is.
And it's fresher than you think it might be. That balsamy note is definitely there.
The tannins are getting me.
You get a little bit of tannins. Pommard structurally tends to be a little bit... It's right next to Volnay, which is really sort of tender and can run very black raspberry, let's say, in its fruit.
Okay.
And this tends to be a little bit beefier, for sure.
Uh-huh.
A little bit broader shouldered, meaning that the density of the wine in your mouth is greater and tends to have a little more sort of chewy tannin to it. Classically, this is beef for like steak frites, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Steak and french fries, that kind of thing.
I may have to run to someplace and have that later.
And it's relatively long on the palate. It's not incredibly like crisp. It's it's firm with the acid, but it's not like bright and crisp. So if that makes sense. All right. When we come back on Formula Wolf on food and wine, and hopefully not too much wine, we'll get into our chef's challenge and take any listener calls or questions. 410-662-8780 is the number to call, or email us formulawolf@wypr.org. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine.
That was fun, Tony. That was thanks for doing that. I always love tasting with you, and I thought that was it's a great bottle of wine and great way of getting to learn about it.
I think people make it a little more intimidating or a little more involved, and they see a long series of wines, and a pro can do very quick analysis on those kinds of things. But
sure,
if it's something that you're buying to enjoy, or that you're someone's home to enjoy, you know, like if you're in a restaurant and it's something that you've spoken to a sommelier and that it should be something that's special, take your time. Actually, mm-hmm. you know, get to know it. It's a lot more fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's no right or wrong. That's what I also appreciate about the way you approach that, which is, you know, it's really just, as you say, just meant to be enjoyed.
Well, it's like music. People play music for you to enjoy it. They make wine for you to enjoy it. That's...
No, you're ready for your chef's challenge?
Already?
You're going to really like this one.
Already?
It's very vague.
I remind listeners, if you want to butt in with a call in the middle of the chef's challenge, you're welcome to.
Do it.
Call in with your color commentary. It's 410-662-8780. Toll free 866-661-9309. Or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we've gotten a decent number of emails today. Folks are shy about being
nice.
On the radio, I guess. That's fine.
We like to hear from people.
All right. Do you want me to do mine first?
Uh-huh. So your situation is that product has all come from either my farm or from the farm down the road, and you're cooking at my farm.
Well, I guess I better build a fire. Got a door out of your basement to give myself some workspace. Hope it's not going to rain. All right. Let's see.
As I said, it's a little vague.
Yeah, it's
for a chef's challenge. Gives you some room to stretch your legs.
This is kind of vague. Hubbard squash. Crooked neck squash. Got squash on the mind. Whole chicken. An entire spice cabinet. Full pantry. Wine cellar. All dairy and chestnuts. Well, I really like some other vegetables and things to serve with the chicken. I mean, because I want to turn the Hubbard squash into some kind of a pie. I have empanadas in my brain right now. So what I'd want to do with the Hubbard squash is to make a puree and make it really tight, roast those guys until they're almost a little bit dry. I'd roast them with a little bit of chilies and brown sugar and a little bit of cinnamon and star anise and let them even maybe dry in a warm oven. Like 150 degrees, 170 degrees overnight. Try to get all the water out of there I possibly can to get really good concentration, because what I want is a pretty tight puree from that Hubbard, and it's hard to do. And I may have to cook it down a bit after that anyway. And a little bit of salt also on those guys. You have to get the water out. When I cook that down and have it tight enough, I want to add a little bit of cachaca, the Brazilian spirit made from sugarcane. And tighten up a little bit further. You said all dairy, and a little bit of cream, and an egg, and maybe even a tiny little bit of a breadcrumb. And if you said all dairy, I'd put a little bit of ricotta in it as well, and then sweeten it up at the end with a little bit of sugar and brown sugar. And I'd like to make little pastries out of them. So if there's flour and all the baking stuff in the pantry, and I'd make the pastries with half butter, half lard.
There you go.
A little bit sweet. Nice little triangle empanadas that you bake in the oven until they're crispy on the outside.
And baking them.
Yeah, baking them.
That's nice.
And I think that'd be kind of a fun...
That would be good.
That's a fun something to finish with.
You could even sprinkle little spices on the outside of it.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Well, exactly.
To have that hit your tongue first, before you actually taste what's inside.
You can make it a little bit unexpected.
Pastry.
You could toast cardamom pods with sugar. And then make caramel with that, brush them with the caramel, and then sprinkle a little bit of salt and a tiny bit of cayenne.
Nice.
On the outside of those guys. So there are those, which would be last. And boy, I wish that's like some really fat dessert wine. That's a very South American sort of pastry, so I have to find a ridiculous South American dessert wine, maybe from Tanat or Torontes or something.
Okay.
With that whole chicken... What I want to stuff it with the chestnuts, for sure, with chestnuts and garlic, and if I can steal a little bit of sage from your garden, I would take that. But I'd want to stuff that. If if there was cornbread around, or if I could make
there
cornbread.
There might be.
If it's your house, it's probably cornbread
likely.
Around. Yeah, but I would do chestnut cornbread stuffing with garlic and sage on
my there. Trees are dropping so many chestnuts right now. It's unbelievable. And I have walnuts too. I'm so excited.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
We'll put that. Let's get that on the inside of that bird.
Okay.
And then roast him. In a perfect world, you know, I like a little duck fat for roasting a chicken.
There's definitely duck fat to be had.
So mm-hmm. you season that duck fat a little bit first with a little bit of garlic and onion, and then tuck those in the cavity as well so they perfume your bird, and then take them out. And then you every 10, 15 minutes, once you sear that bird off on top of the range in the roasting pan, you just take it out of the oven and keep basting it with the duck fat and the chicken fat that now commingled in the pan. So probably about, depending upon the size of the bird, an hour, it's an hour 20. And serve that with crooked neck squash. I'd rather make crooked neck squash as a gratin. Hmm. So if there's a little breadcrumb and a little Parmigiano to finish it with, just line a gratin dish, give it a little bit of reduced cream and butter, and that Reggiano and breadcrumb, bake those guys off, little thin slices. So, but I think that's...
Sounds good.
I've used all the stuff you gave me. You said wine cellar, so I'll mm-hmm. find something to go with that.
Yep. What would you want to find to go with that?
Maybe a kind of great big Puy-Fuissé from like 8 or 9 years ago. You know, maybe Christophe Cordier. He's a great producer of rich Puy-Fuissé. So anyway, there's that.
Okay.
Now your challenge. I gave you a less vague story here. So the situation is, mm-hmm. You're given these ingredients, and you're trying for a job.
I already have one.
I know, but back in the old days.
Okay.
When someone would say, you know,
sure,
here's what you got to work with.
Right, right. Chef's challenge.
Cook a couple of dishes for me.
A different type of chef's challenge.
For a tasting, yeah, a different kind of chef's challenge.
Try out. Right. Okay.
It's for your job.
So
it's really
for a job. All
it's
right.
kind of restaurant dishes that you're after.
Well, here we go.
I'm going to give you a minute to think about it because we have a couple of
okay.
A couple of emails that came
all
in.
All right.
And we'll see what we've got here.
I don't even know what this third word is.
That's well, you can have time to
two
figure
it out. Two whole D's. I mean, what is that? Ducks?
Ducks.
What?
Ducks.
Okay.
Two whole D's.
Two whole ducks.
Okay. Eric and Falston, I still can't differentiate all those flavors that people speak of when it comes to wine. Do you have any tips on how to enculturate my palate? That's probably a pretty common question. I think the biggest thing, I think, because I teach a lot of people how to taste, is to slow things down for yourself. You don't have to have all the words. Sometimes if someone's a more experienced taster and they kind of guide you slowly and you find things, that will help you, okay? Julian Arundel, oh, this is nice. Thank you so much for those tips. I look forward to impressing my friends with my new skills at our next dinner party. All right. Now, are you ready for your challenge?
Okay. So it's one rouge pumpkin, a pound of navy beans, two whole ducks, some quantity of lamb belly. I can't read it. Pardon me. Fresh arugula, watermelon radishes, a jar of cherry tomatoes from summer, daled baguette, butter, walnuts, Calabrian chilies, Asian pears, Concord grapes, which are great because we're getting them right now, rosemary and porcini mushrooms. So
it's a fun basket.
Yeah, it is.
And you got about 4 minutes to tell everyone what you're going to do with it.
Okay, I'm going to cook those white beans. Let me see how fast. I'm from Indiana, part of my life. We talk fast. I'm going to make a salad with the navy beans and the arugula and the watermelon radishes and the cherry tomatoes from summer and the day-old baguette. How about that?
That sounds good.
Yeah.
A little panzanella.
Yeah. And so that is the salad. I have to cook the beans, obviously. And I would cook them in something neutral, chicken stock and water and salt. Just chicken stock and salt.
And if you've got a little bit of broth. And a little bit of that broth and good vinegar to go with the oil in that salad. That would
mm-hmm.
be awesome.
Mm-hmm. The Concord grapes would be wonderful with the duck and the porcini mushrooms. And I'm kind of thinking, what am I going to do with those? All right. I'm definitely going to put, you have the Asian pears. So those are going to get sliced thin and sauteed in a little bit of butter with the Calabrian chilies. And I'm going to add walnuts to the pan. And I'm going to finish with a few grapes And then I'm going to throw the rosemary in. No, I'm not. I'll add the rosemary to the porcini mushrooms in a separate pan. So I will, actually, I'm going to grill the porcini mushrooms with rosemary and extra virgin olive oil. So the duck is going to get roasted whole. Then I will take the legs off, throw them on the grill for a little bit to just kind of char them on the outside. Hopefully it's a wood grill. Get some good flavor into the legs. Then cut the breasts off, thinly slice them, and serve them with that mixture of the pears, the grapes, and the walnuts, and the chilies, and then have the porcini mushrooms with the rosemary next to that on the plate. The lamb belly should have gone in with the beans to cook for the salad. And I've ignored the pumpkin. Yeah. All right, so the pumpkin, yeah. The point of the show. Yeah, the pumpkin, I'm going to roast, puree, add a little cream and eggs to. I'm going to make a pumpkin flan, and that will be my dessert. And I'll definitely put some traditional spices in, maybe a little bit of rum, cinnamon, and a tiny bit of molasses, because I love the idea of flavoring pumpkin with molasses.
You know, I was thinking about, you just started to say, oh, I have to do, like, you're like, same thing that often happens to me when I have a long list. It's like, oh, gosh, I've got this one thing I still have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
That lamb belly, if you got that crispy and then pulled it as a garnish for, if you wanted to make soup with that rouge pumpkin, that might be kind of awesome. Or if there was, if you could find arborio rice and make a pumpkin risotto with a crispy lamb belly as a garnish, that might be.
Well, you could do the soup with the pumpkin, the navy beans. Some stock made from the duck bones.
I love the salad idea.
And the lamb belly. Mm-hmm.
I love the salad idea.
That's stuff. Lots of ingredients.
We have an email from Dave in Mount Washington. I have a great crop of parsnips. However, I've been told they are sweeter and better if you pick them after numerous hard frosts. Is that true? Is it worth keeping them in the ground for a couple more months? So, I think it really depends upon if you like them right now. You know, harvest a lot of them. I mean, that's if you don't like them right now and you want to see how they ride out. I don't know how to predict the weather perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem like we're going to get some more rain. You know, we've been on the once a week rain plan for a little while, so that sounds like a pretty long season. But I'm not going to prognosticate on the weather for the parsnips. But if they're nice and sweet right now.
Go for it.
I don't know. I would go for it.
I still have carrots I need to pull, and I'm just trying to let them get a little size, but I probably ought to pull them. Yeah, and my beets are gone.
That's what happens to beets. I think we're just about out of time. So thanks for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. If you want to download this program or any others, you can go to the WYPR website, wypr.org, and look for the Foreman & Wolf webpage. If you want to email us, and you've been good at that today, please send us questions, comments to foremanwolf@wypr.org. And if you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Cindy Wolf or on Twitter as Chef Wolf.
Thanks so much for listening.
Have a great Sunday.